Hello, I'm Lina Khmudu. Welcome to Health Chat. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR's 2024 Global Trends Report reveals that forced displacement has increased to historic new levels worldwide over the past 2 years. The devastating war in Sudan has contributed to the spike. Since April 2023, more than 7.1 million people have been displaced within the country, and almost 2 million have been forced to flee to neighboring countries. Observers say refugee camps are overcrowded and underfunded, lacking essential services such as clean water, sanitation, and health care. Compounding this dire situation is a widespread malnutrition crisis. Here is more.
More than 750,000 people could face catastrophic food shortages in Sudan by September. That's according to a preliminary projection used by United Nations agencies and aid groups to determine whether famine should be officially declared. The preliminary results, as of June the 1st, represent a rapidly deteriorating situation in the war-torn country. Since April last year, the Sudanese army has been fighting the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. On Wednesday, WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said 12 million people have been displaced in what is the world's largest humanitarian crisis.
People are dying from a lack of access to essential services and medicines, while there is a very real risk of mass starvation in some regions.
The latest projection by the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, or IPC, states that between June and September, an estimated 756,000 people will be in Phase 5 catastrophe. That means the country has not yet reached famine, but is still considered a major crisis. By comparison, the last IPC projection, released in December, did not classify anyone as being in a catastrophic situation. The latest projection is preliminary and could change. It would also require approval by Sudan's military-run government as well as UN and international agencies. Whether a famine could be declared is unclear. In areas formally designated as Phase 5 famine, more than 2 people per 10,000 are dying daily, among other criteria. Governments sometimes challenge famine data and projections, and Sudan's government has previously denied that the country is experiencing famine. However, the US Special Envoy to Sudan said last week that some parts of the country are already there. The question, Tom Perriello said, is how much famine, how much of the country, and for how long?
That was Reuters' David Doyle reporting. For more on the humanitarian crisis in Sudan, I spoke with Igor Garcia, communications advisor for Médecins Sans Frontières, MSF. Igor Garcia, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Can you provide an overview of the current humanitarian situation in Sudan and among the displaced? What are the most pressing needs, particularly when it comes to their medical needs?
Yeah, so the war in Sudan has been ongoing for over a year now, and the situation is catastrophic across a country that is the third one most populated in Africa. It's a country the size of countries like Spain in terms of population, nearly 50 million, half of them are in need of humanitarian assistance, a fifth of them have been forced out of their homes. The majority, they are internally displaced across different areas of the country, but we have nearly 2 million people who have sought refuge in neighboring countries like Chad, Egypt, or South Sudan. Overall, the fighting continues to be very heavy in several places of the country, particularly in Khartoum, in the state of Jazeera, but also in Darfur. And it's affecting directly the civilian population. We see every day a lot of injured people. But the indirect consequence of this very active fighting is that people have nothing. They have lost their livelihood. They have lost their homes. They have lost relatives. And at the moment, there is very insignificant humanitarian assistance being provided to them because it's extremely difficult to work today in Sudan because, from one hand, there is insecurity. There is a difficult environment. Perpetrated or prepared by the warring parties, and there are also numerous obstructions by the authorities in terms of visas, in terms of travel permits to cross the front lines, and it's altogether proving very, very complicated in order to deploy a humanitarian response in Sudan. So today, people in Sudan are lacking a proper shelter, food, they are lacking access to healthcare. Many health structures are not functional, particularly in the conflict areas, and the situation is desperate.
So when it comes to the issue of malnutrition, can you give us a sense of what is happening? Because we're seeing numbers that are very, very concerning. So what is the situation there? And do you have some statistics or observations regarding the rate of malnutrition, especially among children?
Yeah, so of course, malnutrition is one of the most important or the most serious consequences when there is a situation of war. And we are already seeing a problem of malnutrition in different areas of Sudan. For example, in North Darfur state, in the Sansan camp where MSF teams are working, we did a mass screening of more than 40,000 children. In total, about 60,000 plus children and breastfeeding women and pregnant women. And the rates of malnutrition were very, very high above the emergency threshold. We found out that out of the screened children under the age of 5 years, 30% of them were severely acute malnourished, and 8% of them were facing the most severe form of malnutrition. We have been witnessing this situation already for months. We have called for increased support. We have called for other actors to scale up, to deploy, but the assistance is not arriving. And this is just one place in Sudan. What we are witnessing in North Darfur is just an example. We are seeing similar situations, maybe not to the same scale, but the situation is continuously worsening, and we think it could be much worse if no aid is deployed, if no action is taken.
How is Médecins Sans Frontières addressing this issue right now, the shortages of food, clean water, and medicine? What is being done?
We are currently working as MSF in 9 states of Sudan, both in areas controlled by the rapid support forces, mostly in the western side of the country, but also by the government of Sudan, in places such as Khartoum or Gedaref or the Blue Nile. And we do different activities. We work in health structures, supporting Ministry of Health structures like hospitals and health centers, doing activities such as treating people who are injured by the violence, but also providing maternity care, assisting women give birth, treating children that are sick with different kinds of conditions, managing the emergency rooms in some of the places. And we are also addressing other needs, like sometimes it could be the provision of water, it could be vaccination. Vaccines are running short in many areas of the country, and this is why we are also very concerned, because in the past year we have already seen different outbreaks of disease, for example of measles, for example of cholera, and this is something that can be recurrent if action is not taken, if vaccines are not provided to the children, to the vulnerable groups. No, we are working also in displaced settings, either displaced camps, but also in refugee camps, because let's not forget that the situation in Sudan was already critical, or it was already complicated ahead of the war. Sudan was hosting many refugees from neighboring countries, such as Ethiopia, but also South Sudan, because the region has been prone to different conflicts over the recent years. And of course, when the new fighting started last April, in April 2023, this situation that was already complicated became much worse, no? And now many of the organizations that were working back in 2023 in Sudan have not returned yet after they evacuated. No? So what we are calling is for the United Nations to exert an adequate leadership at the height of this crisis, but also to the other international organizations to step up their efforts to provide assistance, and to the authorities, to both warring parties, to allow unimpeded access to the populations in need wherever they are. No? Because we think that part of the problem in scaling up the response to the current situation in Sudan is the obstructions that we are facing by the different authorities.
So what is your message to the international community or in general?
We are talking about one of the largest crises that we have seen in the last decades. We are talking about probably one of the highest displacement crises. We are talking about nearly 10 million people that in the course of the last year have been forced out of their homes. And we are talking about a crisis that is profoundly neglected by the international community. There is barely attention being paid to what's happening in Sudan. We need that people pay more attention about what's happening in Sudan, because there is a lot of suffering and much more can be done, and should be done soon. Yeah?
Igor Garcia, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you for this space.
That was Igor Garcia, MSF Communications Advisor. The latest World Health Organization report on tuberculosis attributes one out of every five active TB infections to undernourishment. That's a big problem in several African countries, including Sudan and the Democratic Republic of Congo, due to months of insecurity and conflict. Climate change, which also forces people to leave their homes, can increase the number of TB cases too. Dr. Maria Beaumont, Chief Medical Officer for the TB Alliance, tells VOA's Carol Van Damme it's difficult for many refugees or poverty-stricken people to take precautions against the disease when they are living in crowded and sanitary conditions.
If there's a lot of people living under the same roof, especially when it's winter months, it's cold, so people tend to be closer, there's no ventilation. That is when actually any airborne disease tends to spread more easily. There's also some risk factors that certainly will predispose patients to become actively infected with tuberculosis, malnourishment, undernourishment, or HIV certainly also facilitate the acquisition and the spread of the disease in the body. And also something else that's going to really impact spread of disease will be the high burden cases. So there's some patients that do not have as much tuberculosis in terms of loads of mycobacterium than others, and these persons will tend to spread more.
So speaking of that, I just heard from a colleague that she had to go in for something unrelated, and they said that you might have had TB, but your immunity threw it off. Is that a thing? Like people can get infected, and if their immunity is strong enough, they can throw it off?
So you can definitely control it to the point that you might never experience any symptoms or any indication of the disease ever again in your life. But at some point when you're older or you have another medical issue that immunosuppresses you, it could actually reactivate. And actually, reactivation of latent infection is one of the ways in which people suddenly develop tuberculosis, not just acutely acquired from somebody else close by.
What has been the economic impact of TB in these kinds of countries that you've just described, in places where there's lots and lots of refugees?
Well, I mean, and going back to what I was saying, fortunately, it's a vicious cycle. So tuberculosis is a disease of poverty, the highest burden of disease. It's currently in those less resourced countries. And so already they are economically impacted. When patients are weakened from now their chronic infection, they cannot have a productive life, and so they're only becoming more impoverished. For this, a quick turnaround of the situation by a treatment that is easily accessible, that will be short and can get you back on your feet faster, and also that could cure you so that you cannot spread disease any further within your household or outside of your household, that can have an impact on the economic situation and the capacity of the patient and the family to be productive.
Can you tell us about some of the new cures for TB that have dramatically cut down on treatment time for patients?
Yes, there is a regimen that we are very proud of because we are part of the development of this regimen, and that is called BPAL. It's a combination of three compounds, bedaquiline, prethamidine, and linezolid, with or without a fourth drug that's called moxifloxacin. This regimen now is the recommendation, the first-line recommendation by WHO for the treatment of patients with resistant tuberculosis. And the reason why this is such a great advance in medicine and the approach of this disease, because it has shortened treatment from what used to be 18 months or even longer to 6 months. And doing that not only also improved tolerability, because this is an all oral regimen that you take once a day compared to the longer treatment, including injectables. So daily injectables for 18 months, success rates were between 50 to 60%, while the new one also increased cure rates to around 90%.
Oh, that's a huge difference.
It's a huge difference. And this is not something that we observed in the clinical trials, which are known for having better responses than actually in real life or in the clinic.
So, of course, that sounds super effective. How accessible are those new cures in Africa?
It depends from country to country, but since WHO updated guidelines in 2022, all governments have started to procure this new regimen, and so it's becoming more and more accessible everywhere.
You are listening to Health Chat on Voice of America. It's time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Health Chat. Telemedicine or telehealth has been a significant alternative in healthcare delivery worldwide during the COVID-19 global pandemic. The healthcare delivery model gained momentum in Africa before the coronavirus outbreak, driven by the rapid expansion and mobile networks and internet connectivity across the continent. Observers say telemedicine offers a unique opportunity to provide needed care for all and everywhere. However, access remains limited in parts of Africa due to issues such as poor infrastructure, insufficient information, and lack of adequate financing. For more insight, I spoke with Jack Bonjawo, author, computer scientist, and president and CEO of Ocean Innovation Center. He played a significant role in introducing and expanding telemedicine in Cameroon and beyond.
You are a pioneer when it comes to the promotion of telemedicine in Africa. How did you, first of all, think about telemedicine and its importance on the continent back in the days?
I was a Microsoft manager in the headquarters of Microsoft in Redmond. I spent nearly 10 years there, and then I realized that you could leverage technology to do a great deal. Therefore, when I moved back to Africa back in 2010, I wanted to do something for the continent. And one of the things that came in mind was telemedicine and also distance learning, distance education. Yes. Because I realized that these two key technologies can really help us leverage the economy and the success of the African continent.
Talk to us about the first steps that you took to make sure that this approach in healthcare could be accessible on the continent.
The first step was to raise awareness. That's always very important because a lot of people were skeptical. Yes. About telemedicine. As a matter of fact, most people prefer things like in-person visit to their doctor. Therefore, you have to raise that awareness so that everybody understands that telemedicine is there to help. We also had to ensure that the internet connectivity was working, because as you know, we have some electricity problems in most of African countries. We have a lot of connectivity problems. It's not always reliable. These are some of the challenges we have to face before we can set up the telemedicine system. But we were there actually for the challenges, and we managed to move on and be successful with these challenges.
So you said you moved on and you were successful. Talk to us today about how you assess where we are now versus, of course, where we were when you started. How do you assess how telemedicine grew on the continent?
There has been significant progress, I should say. For instance, when you look at the smartphone in Africa, a lot of people have smartphones, and we thought that mobile technology was one of the best way to leverage the power of telemedicine. As a matter of fact, even in the remote areas or remote villages, most people have cell phones. So we use that for health education. We use that for telemedicine. We use that for distant learning or distant training. And that's worked very well.
So when we talk about telemedicine, of course, many people know, have an idea. But how can we simply define it?
Well, telemedicine is about, it's all about medicine from the distance, meaning yes. that when people are in remote areas, they don't always have easy access to healthcare. So they are like the underserved. To make sure that these people do have access to quality healthcare, mm-hmm. you have to set up the telemedicine system, which simply means that they can have remote consultation. Okay. You can see a doctor via video conference. You can see a doctor and have your consultation from a remote area, mm-hmm. wherever the doctor is. The doctor doesn't even have to be in the same country as you are. The doctor can be in a different country.
So let's talk about the moving parts when we talk about telemedicine. Of course, you talked about mobile technology. A cell phone can be a tool. Internet is needed, electricity. The doctor is needed. What else comes into play when it comes to telemedicine?
Training is needed. You have to train the professionals on how to use telemedicine. They know how to take care of the patient. They know how to use their traditional tools to solve healthcare problems. But they don't necessarily know how to use the new tools,
yes.
such as artificial intelligence, to solve the problems of telemedicine. So you have that aspect of training. You also have to make sure that you have all it takes to set up the system, because the initial cost of telemedicine is relatively high. So you have to reach a certain number of patients before you can break even. So it takes some time. It takes time to implement the telemedicine system.
You mentioned artificial intelligence. How do you see the role that technologies such as AI will play in advancing telemedicine on the continent specifically?
I think that AI will do a lot. It is actually being used already for telemedicine or for healthcare in general. For instance, if you want to monitor some patients, you don't have to have a nurse always close to the patient. You can have a system of AI that check the blood pressure, for instance, and send the results to the nurse. So the nurse still have work to do. The nurse will not lose their job just because AI is there. But AI will be very reliable in terms of taking the numbers, so to speak. As I said, if we want to take the blood pressure and also all other types of numbers,
yes.
AI is more reliable than the human being, which in no ways means that you will not need a human being. You still need to have the personal touch of each doctor with their patients.
Okay, so I think some people will be happy to know that jobs will not be lost because of AI or telemedicine, right?
That's exactly right. Even if you lose a job, the system might create another one. So okay. What you need to do is just do more training for the new opportunities that arise.
Now, let's talk about data privacy, because that's one of the challenges. We've seen cases where there were leaks. How does telemedicine ensure data privacy for patients?
Yeah, first of all, you have to set up a system that is very robust in terms of security. For instance, we use, as technicians, we use what you call end-to-end encryption, meaning the data is encrypted from one end to the other end.
Mm-hmm.
That really secures that you're not going to violate the privacy of the patient. But having said that, there would still be people who could try to get the confidentiality of the data. That has nothing to do with the technology itself. It just has to do with the way you use the technology.
Now, let's talk about the limitations of telemedicine. As we know, it's a great addition to healthcare in general, but it cannot do everything. So what are some of those limitations and how can some of them be overcome?
Yes, one of the challenges or the limitation, if you will, is the cost of implementing the telemedicine. The other challenge is the fact that, as I said, when you go in to see a doctor, it's not the same thing as seeing the doctor remotely, so to speak. It's not exactly the same thing, even if you can get the same cure, but it's not exactly the same thing.
Yes.
As you know, sometimes just seeing a doctor, it's enough for some type of patient just to get healed. We know that.
Yes.
Therefore, that's one of the challenges. I would say that another challenge is the fact that it's the adoption. People have to really adopt telemedicine because in some countries you still have some kind of cultural barriers, so to speak. You know, people don't want things like technology to interfere with their health. And also, you mentioned it, the privacy, the data privacy element.
What are the key regulatory issues affecting telemedicine today, especially when we look at Africa? How well regulated is it, and what can be done?
There is lack of regulation, so to speak. And that's a problem because when you want to implement telemedicine, you need to have some kind of license to do that. So there is a licensing issue. Who should give you the license? It's the government.
Yes.
And if there's no license, what you're doing, it's in a way illegal.
Illegal.
Absolutely illegal. So we were working on telemedicine at least at the beginning, knowing that we were doing good, but at the same time, it was sort of illegal what we were doing. But thankfully, the government let us do our job.
Okay.
Therefore, we were able to move forward.
So how can government ensure that the regulations are there and also ensure that telemedicine is more accessible to people in Africa?
Yes, in terms of the regulation, the government just has to work with all the stakeholders. Government needs advice from healthcare providers, need advice from technology specialists like us, need advice from even to hear from patients before they can put together some type of regulation.
Okay, and finally, how can telemedicine be more accessible on the continent?
More accessible means having more infrastructure, technology infrastructure, having more access to the internet, to electricity, and therefore the government has to do something about it, to invest a lot. It also means that the cost has to be reduced in a sense, because if the cost is relatively high, a patient will not be able to pay for their health.
Jack Bonjawo, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
That was Jack Bonjawo, President CEO of Ocean Innovation Center in Cameroon.
VOA Africa is your trusted source for news, sports, entertainment, and music. Stay engaged with VOA Africa. We love to hear your voice. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message. Leave comments, requests, or greetings. We may play your message on VOA Africa. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. VOA Africa is always happy to hear your voice. The number again is the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.
That is all for this edition of Health Chat. Thank you everyone for joining us, and thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Lino Mudu in Washington, with producer Mukbilia Baro. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and strive to make every day a healthy day.